blessed country.
At Crichton Abbey by Mary Elizabeth Braddon. The Crichtons were very great people in that part of the country where my childhood and youth were spent. To speak of Squire Crichton was to speak of a power in that remote western region of England. Crichton Abbey had belonged to the family ever since the reign of King Stephen and was of noble and palatial proportions. Altogether, the abbey was a very splendid mansion and one of the chief glories of our county. I was a Crichton, and my father, a distant cousin of the reigning squire, had been rector of Crichton Parish. His death left me utterly unprovided for, and I was fain to go out into the bleak unknown world and earn my living in a position of dependence, a dreadful thing for a Crichton to be obliged to do. I made it my business to seek employment abroad, where the degradation of one solitary Crichton was not so likely to inflict shame upon the ancient house to which I belonged. Happily for myself, I had been carefully educated, and I was so fortunate as to obtain a situation at Vienna in a German family of high rank. Here I remained 7 years, laying aside a considerable portion of my salary. When my pupils had grown up, my kind mistress procured me a still more profitable position at St. Petersburg, where I remained 5 more years, at the end of which time I yielded to a yearning that had been long growing upon me to see my dear old country home once more. My mother had died 7 years before my father. My only brother was far away, in the Indian Civil Service. Sister, I had none. I was 33 years of age. Youth was quite gone, beauty I had never possessed, and I was content to think of myself as a confirmed old maid, a quiet spectator of life's great drama, disturbed by no feverish desire for an active part in the play. The dear ones who had given a special charm and brightness to my existence were gone. Nothing could recall them, and without them actual happiness seemed impossible to me. But I was a Crichton, and I loved the soil from which I had sprung. I was encouraged by the very cordial letters from the squire's wife. Mrs. Crichton begged that whenever I felt myself justified in coming home, I would pay a long visit to the abbey. "I wish you could come at Christmas," she wrote in the autumn of the year of which I am speaking. "We shall be very gay, and I expect all kinds of pleasant people at the abbey. Edward is to be married early in the spring. His fiancée is to be among our guests. She is a very beautiful girl, perhaps I should say handsome rather than beautiful. Julia Tremaine, one of the Tremaines of Old Court near Hazewell? She has a considerable fortune left her by an aunt and is thought quite an heiress in the county. It is, I hope and believe, a thorough love match on both sides." This letter decided me. So early in December, I turned my face homewards and made the long journey from St. Petersburg. The old abbey was in its glory when I arrived there, at about 9 o'clock on a clear, starlit night. A light frost whitened the broad sweep of grass that stretched away from the long stone terrace in front of the house. From the music room at the end of the southern wing to the heavily framed Gothic windows of the old rooms on the north, there shone one blaze of light. The scene reminded me of some weird palace in a German legend, and I half expected to see the lights fade out all in a moment, and the long stone facade wrapped in sudden darkness. The old butler came out of the dining room as the footman opened the hall door for me and gave me cordial welcome. "It's a real treat to see your pleasant face once more, Miss Sarah," said this faithful retainer. "You look a trifle older than when you used to live at the vicarage 12 years ago, but you're looking uncommon well for all that, and Lord love your heart, miss, how pleased they all will be to see you. Call Mrs. Marjoram James, will you?" The footman disappeared into the black regions and presently reappeared with Mrs. Marjoram. From her I received the same cordial greeting, and by her I was led off up staircases and along corridor till I wondered where I was being taken. We arrived at last at a very comfortable room, a square tapestried chamber, cheery enough with a bright fire roaring in the wide chimney. But it had a somewhat ancient aspect, which the superstitiously inclined might have associated with possible ghosts. I was utterly skeptical upon the ghost subject, and the old-fashioned appearance of the room took my fancy. "We are in King Stephen's wing, are we not, Mrs. Marjoram?" I asked. "This room seems quite strange to me. I doubt if I have ever been in it before."
"Very likely not, miss. Yes, this is the old wing. Your window looks out onto the old stable-yard where the kennel used to be in the time of our squire's grandfather. We are so full of company this winter, you see, miss, that we are obliged to make use of all these rooms. You'll have no need to feel lonesome."
The old woman begged to be excused for leaving me. She had so much on her hands just now. "I'll be down in the drawing-room in 10 minutes. Are there many people there, by the by?"
"A good many. There's Miss Tremaine and her mamma and younger sister. Of course, you've heard all about the marriage. Such a handsome young lady. Rather too proud for my liking, but the Tremaines always were a proud family. Mr. Edward is so fond of her, thinks the ground is scarcely good enough for her to walk upon, I do believe. And somehow I can't help wishing he'd chosen someone else, someone would have thought more of him, and who would not take all of his attentions in such a cool, off-hand way. But of course it isn't my business to say such things, and I wouldn't venture upon it to anyone but you, Miss Sarah."
She told me that I would find dinner ready for me in the breakfast-room, and then bustled off. I changed as rapidly as I could, admiring the perfect comfort of my chamber as I dressed. In the background, the tapestried walls loomed duskily as they had done hundreds of years before my time. I arranged my hair in its usual simple fashion, put on a dark gray silk dress, tied a massive gold cross round my neck with a scarlet ribbon, and my costume was complete. One glance at the looking-glass convinced me that there was nothing dowdy in my appearance, and then I hurried along the corridor and down the staircase to the breakfast-room, in which an excellent dinner awaited me. I did not waste much time over this repast, for I was anxious to make my way to the drawing-room. Just as I had finished, the door opened and Mrs. Crichton sailed in. She put her arms round me and kissed me affectionately. "I have only this moment been told of your arrival, my dear Sarah," she said, "and I find you have been in the house half an hour. What must you have thought of me?"
"What can I think of you, except that you are all goodness, my dear Fanny? I did not expect you to leave your guests to receive me, and I am really sorry that you have done so."
"But, my dear child, I have been looking forward so anxiously to your coming, and I should not have liked to see you for the first time before all those people."
"Welcome to Crichton. Remember, Sarah, this house is always to be your home whenever you have need of one."
"My dear, kind cousin, and you are not ashamed of me who have eaten the bread of strangers?"
"Ashamed of you? No, my love, I admire your industry and spirit. And now come to the drawing-room. The girls will be so pleased to see you."
"And I to see them. They were quite little things when I went away, and now I suppose they're handsome young women."
"They are very nice-looking, not as handsome as their brother. Edward is really a magnificent young man. I do not think my maternal pride is guilty of any gross exaggeration when I say that."
"And Miss Tremaine," I said, "I'm very curious to see her." I fancied a faint shadow came over my cousin's face.
"Miss Tremaine, yes, you cannot fail to admire her," she said rather thoughtfully.
She drew my hand through her arm and led me to the drawing-room, a very large room with a fireplace at each end, brilliantly lighted tonight and containing about 20 people all talking and laughing merrily. Mrs. Crichton took me straight to one of the fireplaces, beside which two girls were sitting on a low sofa, while a young man of something more than 6 feet high stood near them. A glance told me that this young man, with the dark eyes and crisp waving brown hair, was Edward Crichton. I remembered the boyish face and bright eyes which had so often looked up to mine. The lady seated nearest Edward Crichton attracted my chief attention. She was tall and slim, and carried her head and neck with a stately air. Yes, she was undeniably handsome, and I could not fail to admire her, but to me the dazzling fair face and its perfect features were the very reverse of sympathetic. I could not understand how any man could fall in love with such a woman. To this young lady Mrs. Crichton introduced me. "I have another cousin to present to you, Julia.
she said, smiling. Miss Sarah Crichton just arrived from St. Petersburg.
From St. Petersburg? What an awful journey. How do you do, Miss Crichton? It was really very courageous of you to come so far.
I saw the cold blue eyes surveying me curiously from head to foot, and it seemed to me as if I could read the condemnatory summing up, a frump and poor relation, in Miss Tremaine's face.
Edward Crichton suddenly seized both my hands and gave me so hearty and loving a welcome that he almost brought the tears up from my heart into my eyes. Two pretty girls in blue crepe came running and gaily saluted me as Cousin Sarah, and the three surrounded me in a little cluster and assailed me with a string of questions. Whether I remembered this and whether I'd forgotten that, the battle in the hayfield, our picnics in Halsley Combe, and all the simple pleasures of their childhood and my youth. While this catechism was going on, Miss Tremaine watched us with a disdainful expression.
"I should not have thought you capable of such Arcadian simplicity, Mr. Crichton," she said at last. "Pray continue your recollections. These juvenile experiences are most interesting."
"I don't expect you to be interested in them, Julia," Edward answered, with a tone that sounded rather too bitter for a lover. "I know what a contempt you have for the trifling rustic pleasures. Were you ever a child yourself, I wonder, by the way? I don't believe you ever ran after a butterfly in your life."
Her speech put an end to our talk of the past somehow, and I saw that Edward was vexed, and that all the pleasant memories of his boyhood had fled before that cold, scornful face. Edward devoted himself for the rest of the evening to his betrothed. I glanced at his bright, expressive face now and then as he talked to her, and could not help wondering what charm he could discover in one who seemed to me so unworthy of him.
He sent his servant to the town, the place where she was dwelling. Saying, "Master dear has sent me here, if you be Barbara Allen."
It was midnight when I went back to my room in the north wing, thoroughly happy in the cordial welcome that had been given me.